Okay. We finished through section number 2 on page 13 in the workbook. Deepak, we have a new page, page 7, or do you want the whole set? Take the what? Okay. All right, remember, how does Daniel organize this whole first chapter? What phrase does Daniel seem to organize his flow of thought around? Which means that it's a repeated phrase. Yeah, God gave, exactly. God gave. We see in the first 7 verses, God gave Jehoiakim and Jerusalem into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And then in the second section, verses 8 through 16, God gave Daniel favor before the official and the steward that's under the official regarding their desire to have a different diet, not out of health reasons, but out of a desire to resist total assimilation, to maintain as much as they can some semblance of their distinctive identity as the people of Yahweh. And then in section 17 through 21, we see that God gave them the ability to pass with flying colors the tests that Nebuchadnezzar put them under. So 3 God gave, and we'll see that. That the notebook asks a question, goes over that on page 14 under Gospel Glimpses. So this evening, what we want to do is we want to do section 3, verses 17 through 21. And then we want to look at also the question. We also want to look at Gospel Glimpses, whole Bible connections, theological soundings, and then any other notes or impressions that you have from this first chapter. So hopefully we can do that this evening. So anyway, let me read chapter 1 again, and then we'll get into that last section, verses 17 through 21. And Daniel writes this. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. With some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the other youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king." Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink." Vegetables is more accurately plant food, anything plant. So it could be vegetables, fruit, grains. Anyway, give your servants, test your servants for 4 days. Let us be given plant food to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter, that is, healthier or fitter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables or plant food. As for these 4 youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better. I don't know if he used written tests to tell that, to quantitate that. But he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Okay. We had good times in those first 16 verses. But now we are ready for verses 17 through 21, this third section in the notebook at the bottom of page 13, Daniel and his friends promoted and preserved. The author's paragraph reads like this. This first chapter climaxes when King Nebuchadnezzar tests Daniel and his 3 friends in their learning. And the text isn't bashful about telling us they passed the test with flying colors. In fact, it says they were 10 times better than anyone else. Why, though, do you think this point is emphasized? There's not a right or wrong answer here. He's asking what you think. Daniel emphasized this point. 10 times better. That's the emphasis he's talking about there.
Set apart and to still be different as Israelites.
Yeah. Yes, Joe says it's God blessing their desire, their resolve to not be totally assimilated into Babylonian culture. And God blessed that. And this is the evidence of it. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? These 15-year-olds, these teenagers, up against, you know, captives of the most powerful empire on the earth. You know, what can they do? I mean, they had to feel incredibly intimidated, and yet they resolved to resist being totally assimilated into the Babylonian culture. And yet, at the end of the, as they did that, and God honored that resolve and allowed them that form of resistance by not eating the food and drinking the wine that the king had assigned to them. They, even though they resisted as much as they could, total assimilation in Babylonian culture, yet they knew 10 times better all of the wisdom and literature of the Babylonians. That's pretty amazing. And you missed our discussion last week. Yeah, exactly. Couldn't hurt, right? Well, it may. There's some proteins you can only get from animal flesh. We don't want to go down that path. And how do we know that Daniel isn't just comparing them to the other exiles that were put through that 3-year training?
The text says that they were compared to all the magicians and the wise men of Babylon.
Yeah, exactly.
What I put down here was that this was setting the table. I like that it was confidence building and reassuring for the exiles to know that they were 10 times better.
I mean, head swelling.
This is Nebuchadnezzar, you know,
himself.
Finding that.
Yes.
And with what's coming in chapter 2, I thought that their credibility was going to be, you know, immediately tapped into as far as, you know,
yeah.
The Babylonian powers were not able to interpret.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's going to get a steady diet of it, isn't he? Not only chapter 2, but chapter 3 and chapter 4. And then his son just did not learn a thing, and he's going to find that out in chapter 5. Or his grandson, whichever it is. Anybody else put anything else down there? Okay. Yeah, one other thing that I added was it's because he asks, why though do you think, he says, why do you think this point is emphasized? And another thing that I put down there, because it was something only the Lord could bring about. Just like last week that we looked at in verses 8 through 16, they went on a plant food diet and water. And remember, we looked through 5 views of what that is and landed on the view that we think best fits the context and the Old Testament law and everything else we can bring to the table about this test. The best view is that it is a form of resistance. The only form of resistance they felt they had at their disposal to resist total assimilation into the culture, and that was the reason for it. It wasn't a fast, right? Right. Well, it wasn't a fast because it lasts for 3 years. right? Now, in Daniel 10, you go there and you see he's apparently been eating the king's food and drinking the king's wine, but because of the condition of Israel and the 70 years that Jeremiah prophesied for the Babylonian captivity is near an end, he's in mourning, and so he's not eating those. Now, that's a fast, okay? But this in chapter 1, that's not a fast. That's a three-year thing, and it's simply they're being enculturated into Babylonian culture, and so they're throwing up any kind of resistance they can. And this was the one thing they could control, what they put in their mouths. Remember the test was for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, they appeared much fitter and healthier than all the other exiles, right? Everybody else in the Babylonian university here. Now, all of us, most all of us, have changed diets or gone on diets or stuff like that throughout. We know it takes more than 10 days to get results. This was dramatic results in 10 days. Only the Lord could have brought that about. And I think it's the same way in verses 17 through 21. They were 10 times better, even of all of the magicians and wise men that Babylon had to offer. 10 times better. Only the Lord could have pulled that off, and did. Notice verse 17 starts out, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And so it was something only God could pull off. Okay. And again, also I want to remind us that another thing that these God was the one that gave Jehoiakim and the temple vessels into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. God is the one that gave Daniel favor with the chief of the eunuchs and the steward. God is the one that gave those fourth youths all that skill and knowledge and all that. I just want to keep reminding us the point there is that it demonstrates God's presence with them. His presence with them, even as Jerusalem is besieged and being conquered and people are being carried away. God's the one that orchestrated that. It wasn't just some unavoidable evil that happened. God orchestrated that. And the fact that he gave them favor with the chief of eunuchs and the steward, and in favor, he gave him all of that knowledge and skill that Nebuchadnezzar found amazing, is evidence that he is present there with them in Babylon, and he is working for their welfare, causing them to thrive. And it's the same thing in our lives, right? You know, let me tell you, my IRA took quite a hit this past year. I forget the percentages nationwide, but you know, so it was real easy for me to sit there and bite my fingernails and watch the market every day and wonder what's going to happen and all of that, and then I just kept getting convicted by Daniel 1. You know, God is present with us and all of that. So, and maintaining our welfare, just like he did with these exiles in Babylon, a culture that couldn't have been more opposite than their culture, he demonstrated his presence among them and committed himself to their welfare. He's done the same thing with us. So anyway, that was good for me to be studying this at this time. Okay. Any other comment on that? Verses 17 through 20. Then, on top page 14, the author says, verse 21 looks, at first glance, to be an incidental historical detail tacked onto the end of the story. And Daniel was there in the court of the king of Babylon until the first year of King Cyrus. Who is King Cyrus, and why do you think this is mentioned? What does it say about Daniel? What does it say about God? So he piles four questions at your doorstep there. It can almost seem like just an afterthought here. It's only seven Hebrew words in the original text. And so that first question, who is King Cyrus? We go from Nebuchadnezzar in verse 20 to King Cyrus in verse 21. Who is King Cyrus? Yes, he's king of the Persians, yes, absolutely, who defeated the Babylonians. We'll see that in chapter 5 of Daniel. So, yes, he is. He is indeed. So, why do you think, notice this, What does verses 1 and 2 start with? In chapter 1. Right. So what does verse 21 tell us? The end of the captivity. So that second question, why do you think this is mentioned? That Daniel was there until Cyrus, until the first year of King Cyrus. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what a signal that Daniel and these other three youths are immediately, after 3 years into the captivity, elevated into the higher courts of the government, and shortly thereafter into the highest levels of government. Obviously, that's an amazing signal of God's presence and care. Anything else why you think that that is put there? I mean, anybody else had anything, another thought? Yours is very similar, yeah. Mine was to show that Daniel, a God's servant, outlasted Babylon. Yeah, but both are true. Yeah, he was useful to Nebuchadnezzar at the highest level for the entire captivity, and I've got a quote from Dale Ralph Davis that I'm going to read to you after we go through these four. You'll see that I stole some words out of it in earlier sessions, but I just think it's a great quote. So then that third question, what does it say about Daniel? That he was there at the initial wave of deportees, and he was there when the Persians took over. Yep. It's possible to be faithful to God through a lifelong trial, absolutely. And so, anything else? What, think of something very simple and basic that it says about. He's being protected by God, even more basic. He's there for how long? So what does that say about him? Yes. He's old. It says all those other things. Like Seth said, it says many things about him. The simplest thing it says about him is he's old. Because in verse 6 of Daniel 1, he's 15. That's where we first see Daniel and his three friends. He's 15. Most scholars believe about 15, 14 or 15. We'll go with 15. Verse 20, when he stands before Nebuchadnezzar, remember that's the end of the 3 years of training. So he's 18. So verse 6, he's 15. Verse 20, he's 18. Verse 21, he's 81. Now that's some staying power, isn't it? He's old. Daniel is old. What does it say about God? He's faithful. Absolutely. Faithful in what?
Well, Daniel was faithful and God blessed him.
Right. God was faithful to sustain his people. What else does it say? What else does verse 21 say about God? Yep. He can use any means to accomplish his purpose. Yeah. So who is king in verse 20? Nebuchadnezzar, right? Who's king in verse 21? So what does that say about God? Well, God outlasts him, but even more.
Well, he's the one that, you know, moves the hearts of kings. He sets up kings, puts down.
Yes, he can topple kingdoms. God topples God topples, that's the word. God topples kingdoms while at the same time sustaining his servants. Right? Listen to this. What Dale Ralph Davis says regarding verse 21. He says, so, in verse 21, Babylon, the hairy-chested brute of the world, has dropped with a thud into the mausoleum of history, while fragile Daniel, servant of the Most High God, is still standing on his feet. I like that. I think that's a great way of putting it. That's the picture we get in verse 21. So, Daniel, you can tell Daniel has very skillfully put together these historical highlights here in chapter 1. He introduces us to the whole exile. He starts with the beginning of the exile in verse 1, ends with the end of the exile in verse 21, and he arranges the stories that he shares, the highlights that he shares in 21 around the phrase that emphasizes God's presence and his care. God gave, and his sovereignty, his presence, his care, his sovereignty. Skillfully put together that introduction to us for life in Babylon. Remember the storyline, the Old Testament storyline ended in 2 Kings 25 with the exile. Daniel is picking up that storyline here in chapter 1. And that's the way he introduces us to the exile and life in the exile, is this chapter 1. So, in this workbook, hopefully you were able to read through these next couple of pages, gospel glimpses, whole Bible connections, theological soundings, and so on page 16, the author asks us to take the time to reflect on the implications of Daniel 1, all 21 verses, for your own life today. Consider what you have learned that might lead you to praise God, repent of sin, and trust in his gracious promises. Make notes below on the personal implications for your walk with the Lord of the gospel glimpses, the whole Bible connections, the theological soundings, and then the chapter as a whole. Interested in how the Lord has worked in your heart through these things. So, gospel glimpses. He mentions two things under gospel glimpses. That phrase, God gave. And then he mentions something we haven't talked about, and that is defeat as the path to victory. So that's a couple of gospel glimpses that he lifts out of Daniel chapter 1. Yeah.
That those bookends at the end, beginning and end of chapter 1, just really rang that through for me.
Yes.
And seeing that, you know, from beginning to end, you know, he that's begun a good work and who is faithful to complete it. And he's not going to drop the ball.
Yeah.
He's going to use all the details along the way, exactly how he's got it planned out for his highest glory, and all his enemies along the way are going to see it.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. There's no right or wrong answers here. It's what God did in your heart with these gospel glimpses. Well, I guess I already shared mine, and that was, I was really hit like I hadn't been before about Daniel's use of that phrase, God gave, emphasizing his presence and his sovereign, merciful, gracious presence and his commitment to the welfare of his people. That is very reassuring, right? It was to me. It kept me from over fretting. How about whole Bible connections to the things that that the author lifts out as exile, as covenantal curse? When we talked about that in the first week or two, that the exile was the last of the consequences, last of the curses that God mentioned in the Israel covenant, or Mosaic covenant. We saw that in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 63 through 68. It was the last, there's a whole bunch of curses mentioned, and exile was the last of them. And blessings to the nations. He goes into Daniel. He refers to Jeremiah 29 that we spent an evening on. Jeremiah's letters to the exile. So this section here, whole Bible connections, is supposed to show us, to demonstrate us, to us how this text is connected, how it fits in with the rest of the Old Testament, or the rest of Scripture, its connectedness to it. And those are two things that he brought up. This story of the exile in chapter 1 wasn't God just on the spur of the moment getting mad at Israel and sicking Nebuchadnezzar on him. So that's why we went back and we looked in Deuteronomy, in Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 28, and Jeremiah 25, and various passages, and showed how this was long threatened by God. It was part of the covenantal relationship, the consequences for being unfaithful to God. And then also the blessing to the nations. So anyway, I don't know if you read through that, and if God used the author's comments on those passages to impress anything upon your heart. But if he did, you were called upon to share.
And yet the blessing to the nations was that much greater.
Yeah.
So here, you know, here goes the nation of Israel out of Israel itself into captivity, scattered as it were.
Mm.
And yet now it's the heathen kings, it's the heathen gods that are putting down, the heathen kings that are seeing the glory of God. And it's almost
parallel. Sure. Sure.
God's following the same pattern.
Right. Not letting his people get soft and comfortable, huddled in a corner of the world, pushing them out. Yeah. Obviously, there were different things triggering that, but yes, there's still that parallel. Yeah, absolutely. And so you're saying that excites you to see and encourages you about us being pushed out.
Well, I mean, I think about what's happening in the Congo.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I mean, churches are being built faster than they can write pamphlets about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, updates.
They're under fire at the same time.
Yeah.
And yet the gospel just
explodes. Yes, yes. Yes, very. Yeah, that's a good analogy. Anybody else? Well, one thing that really struck me like it never struck me before, because this isn't the first time I've taught the book of Daniel, but it never struck me before how God prepared the exiles for their captivity. And again, that was looking how that was, that directly falls under whole Bible connections, because going back and, you know, just asking ourselves the question, where in the world, in verses 8 through 13, where in the world that these four teenage boys get this kind of resolve and faithfulness? You just don't sniff that out of the air. Where did that come from? And so that drove me back in to other sections, into the history of Israel and other sections of the scripture, and to look in particular, to look in 2 Chronicles. There's also 2 Kings, but also 2 Chronicles, verse, chapters 33 through 36. That's from Manasseh to the very last king, to the exile. In 2 Kings, it's either 21 or 22 to the chapter 25, end of the book, takes you from Manasseh to the exile. And to see how God raised up Josiah, King Josiah, and had the greatest revival and reforms ever in the history of the nation. And that Josiah, 2 Kings chapter, what is it? 2 Kings chapter, I can't find it right now. I don't know if it's 22, 23, where he is said to be, as far as all the other kings, there's been no king before or after Josiah who has been, 23, did you say? Chapter 23. Who has been as faithful to the Lord, that is, pursuing him via the law that Moses gave, than Josiah. So that includes great-grandpa Hezekiah, and it includes David. So that's remarkable. And so you go back and you look at that, and that was so encouraging to me. It's encouraging in this way to me. It tells me that you and I have been sufficiently prepared by God for the church's life in Babylon. You know, you look at our country now. The church has arrived in Babylon, and we'll be staying. Okay? And so, Daniel 1 and its connections with Josiah and Jeremiah's letter to the exiles tell me God has sufficiently prepared us for our life in the midst of an anti-God, anti-Christ culture that's getting increasingly hostile to the gospel and to gospel-believing, gospel believers. So that was one thing that I'm still reading in 2 Chronicles, and in the history of Israel, it's so captured me. It's just so encouraging. And let me just take this moment to say this. Look at the notes that I handed out to you, because I've got it written there. Page 7, those last notes that I just... read to you. I'll let you read the first two paragraphs on your own. But look at that third paragraph. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah would have been about 11 years of age when Josiah was killed in battle in 609 BC. 4 years later, they were deported to Babylon. Okay? So this, what we read in these first six verses in Daniel 1 is 4 years after King Josiah was killed in battle. So 4 years after that, they were deported to Babylon along with the rest of the royal family and nobility taken in the first stage of Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of Jerusalem and Judea and Judah. The kind of resolve and faithfulness demonstrated by Daniel and his three friends that we see here in chapter 1 comes from spending their formative years not only under the influence of the godly king Josiah, but presumably under the influence of faithful families. Faithful, you know, godly faithful families, godly faithful friends. So this speaks to all of us. We should ask, you know, I don't know how many times I've said to Pam, I am just, you know, it saddens me and creates fear in me as to the kind of country that our grandkids are inheriting, are being brought up in, that our kids currently have to face and that our grandkids are being brought up in. But it shouldn't cause us to fear and tremble, because we see in the life of these four youths that being raised under the influence of godly families, godly friends, resulted in these kinds of youths. These four youths. That's amazing. It shows you the importance of parenting, and not just parenting, not just grandparenting. But it shows you the importance of the life we live as believers together, because that's what our kids and our grandkids are being exposed to. So what I'm saying is this. The reading how God prepared Judah for captivity should be an encouragement and instruction to us. We do not have to fear about the Babylonian captivity of the church, to borrow the title of one of Luther's famous books. Not have to be afraid of the Babylonian captivity of the church, but to be resolved the way the phrase that's used in Daniel 1 about Daniel, he settled it in his heart. We should settle it in our hearts to maintain our testimony and to pass it on to our kids, to pass it on to our friends' kids, to be a part of a local church family that are committed to each other and to each other's spiritual welfare in living faithfully to God, even in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Anyway, that's the thing that's grabbed me most this time around, reading, studying Daniel is that. How God prepares his people to live in the world without being totally assimilated, and to maintain their distinctiveness as his people. You know what the Bible calls that? Light. Israel was supposed to be a light to the Gentiles. Paul tells us in Philippians 2, we are to be a light in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Jesus calls it in Matthew 5 what?
City set
on a hill. And all of that. We need to think about that, how we respond to the anti-God, anti-Christ rhetoric and craziness that we see around us and on social media. You know, it's really easy to have real visceral and angry, negative reactions. But these people, as we heard this morning, these people that we're living amongst, they do not and cannot, they lack the inherent ability to submit themselves to God. And the reason being is because their desires are turned back on them. So they can't submit to God because they don't want to submit to God. And you can't change yourself when you're in that condition. Why? Because you don't want to. There's no desire to. You love. Your desires turn back on yourself. So we need to greet that with compassion and understanding what's going on. Just like in Babylon, they weren't to not settle in and be combative and nasty to the Babylonians they were living amongst. The same thing applies to us.
Nick and I have been talking about planting gardens.
Elaborate.
Well, just the idea of, you know,
oh, yes, told them to plant gardens, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Do you see the importance of putting a text in its whole context? That's what Whole Bible Connections does for us when we pay attention to those things. So, anyway, what about theological soundings? He lifts up two things. The sovereignty of God and Christ in culture.
I just like the present nature of God.
Yeah.
King's court be there. Get to chapter 6, he's in line. He's ruling over the dreams. He's ruling over the king's decisions. He's ruling over the turn whichever way. He's always there.
Yes. Example after example after example of God sovereignly working out his will in everything that happens. So, you know, think about this as you read this. Think about this. The reason Daniel starts his book with these six chapters of historical highlights and these incredible things that happened is by the time you get to the end of chapter 6, you're ready to believe the truthfulness of all these visions in chapters 7 through 12. You know, okay, God's able to give him this stuff, and I believe he gave him these visions, and I believe God's going to do that. That's one of the effects of Daniel starting his book with these six chapters of historical highlights that are just example after example after example of God sovereignly working out his will in everything that happens. So you see that and you think, okay, I'm ready to be told what he's going to do in the future, to be told and believe it and submit to it. What he's going to do in the future. I'm ready. And then anything else in this chapter that God just struck you with?
Well,
It can be something we've already talked about. It can be something we haven't talked about. Just what he's struck you with. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yes, indeed. Well, next week we start chapter 2. Actually, it's week 3, page 19. It's week 3, which is Daniel chapter 2.